It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a number of high school and college mascots are getting a closer look these days. Our guest says it's time to rethink the use of Crusaders as a school name. First, here's a message we get a lot. If you want to be good at something, you got to decide what that something is early on and then put in the hours, maybe 10,000 hours of work to get better. Happens with a lot of stuff. Picking a major in college, playing a sport, playing an instrument growing up. I started preparing to be a talk show host at age one, for example. Okay, not really. On the other hand, how many of you have heard the opposite message that you should try lots of different things before you decide what you want to do? Or that you may never decide you want to do just one thing, and all those different experiences may leave you better off in the long run. Our next guest says that even though that's not a message we hear as often, research shows that in a lot of ways, it's the right one. Generalists do better than specialists. David Epstein is a science writer and the author of the new book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It seems like, and you write about this, the message in the world is going the opposite of the direction you're looking for here. We seem to put more and more focus on getting specialized as early as possible. Is that right?
That's right. And I think that actually did make sense in a lot of areas previously. So in some it didn't, but you know, in some of the research where I look at things like, say, technological innovation, up until about the 90s, most of the breakthroughs were coming from people who were specialized in the sense that when researchers studied them, they did most of their career in like a single technological class of the U.S. Patent Office's technological classes. But with the explosion of the knowledge economy, where specialized information became much more well disseminated and quickly disseminated, the biggest breakthroughs started coming from people who spread their work over a huge number of those technological classes and usually brought one into another and combined them in these new ways. So I do think that it made sense for a lot of types of work, but a lot of things have changed, although sports is an area where it's really going in that direction and it doesn't make sense and didn't make sense before either.
Yeah, let's talk sports, because that seems one that seems really obvious that specializing. The earlier I start playing soccer or baseball or tennis or whatever, the better I'm going to be in the long run. You provide a couple examples. Sometimes it works out that way. Often it doesn't.
Yeah, I kind of thought that too. What, you know, the notion you were articulating, because the Tiger Woods story, you know, where he was on TV golfing at age two, is kind of the most popular development story ever. We don't really know the stories of people like Roger Federer, for example, which is why I open Range with these guys, where he played a ton of different sports. His mother was described as pully, not pushy. He continued playing badminton, basketball, soccer long after his peers were more specialized. You know, when coaches wanted to bump him up a level, he wouldn't do it because he just wanted to hang out with his friends and talk pro wrestling. And so my question was, which of these is the norm? And it turns out that it's definitely the Roger pattern. So all across most sports that scientists look at, they see athletes who go on to become elite have this so-called sampling period early, where they learn these broad general skills that kind of scaffold later specific skills. They learn about their own interests, they learn about their abilities, and they systematically delay specializing until later than their peers who plateau at lower levels.
Now let's talk music. If I'm a parent, and I am, and I wanted my kids to be successful classical musicians, and I don't, but if I did, I might think, okay, let's get that violin in their hand at age two and keep it there. How does that pan out?
Yeah, I think that notion really strengthened with the book, The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, you know, where on page one she talks about the secrets to raising stereotypically successful kids and assigns one of her daughters violin. And to her credit, later in the book, she notes that her daughter says to her, "You picked it, not me," and quits the violin. But that part didn't really get into the public consciousness the same way. But that's really representative of studies of musicians that show the most frequent reason that young musicians quit is the instrument they're playing is not the one that they want to play. So the ones that go on to become elite tend to have that same kind of sampling period that athletes do, where they try a variety of different instruments, and it's sort of once they – and genres, and it's more like once they hit on one that they feel is a fit, that's when their practice hours tend to take off, and they don't plateau the same way.
And you mentioned technological innovation, and when you look in the book at science and the business world too, for that matter – you see a lot of people finding value in being trained in what seem initially to be completely unrelated things. What kind of things did you discover?
Yeah, so and this isn't to say that specialists are unimportant, but for example, as specialists are becoming more and more specialized, what researchers who sort of study business innovation, they have these terms they call exploration and exploitation. What these mean, exploration is like the search for new knowledge and new types of solutions. Exploitation is when you sort of know an area and how you get the most out of it. And increasingly, as people are more and more specialized, the exploration resides outside of their view because they're so narrowly focused, and which is good for exploitation. But this has gotten to such a degree that the guy who used to be the VP of research and development at Eli Lilly started to notice this trend and realizing that some of the most difficult problems that the company had to solve were not being solved by specialists. So he basically stuck them up on the internet. All the scientists thought he was crazy. You know, they said, we're the most specialized, most well-resourced scientists in the world. And he said, then don't worry about it, you know, and solutions started coming in from, like, you know, a lawyer who had worked on a tear gas patent case or something like that. And they were sort of astounded. And it was working so well that he spun this off into its whole separate company called Innocentive that helps other companies post the problems that have gotten them stuck. And it turns out that they're most likely to get solved if they attract people from really far away, from what the researcher who studied Innocentive said, as far away as possible from the problem's home field, they call it. So, like, you know, NASA put up a problem that stumped them for 30 years about predicting solar particle bursts that can damage astronauts and their equipment. And a guy who just retired from a cell phone company solved it in 6 months. And so specialists are important, but the more specialized they get, the more that exploration phase occurs outside of their narrow view.
Talking to David Epstein, author of the new book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. I could see why this could be bad for kids if we make them over-specialize too soon. If nothing else, they might burn out on what they want. But something that struck me in your book is how bad this could be for grown-ups. And I've experienced this myself. I'm too old to learn this thing. I'm not going to be successful. I should have started this when I was a kid. That could steer people away from really productive or cool stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And I think one of the you know, the problem is we're usually being rushed to pick what we want to do when we're maybe in our late teens or our earlier mid-20s, and that turns out to be the fastest time of your personality change. And we actually, people, all psychological finding called the end of history illusion. We all underestimate how much we're going to change in the future. And so usually we're trying to pick our careers when we're in the period of the fastest personality change, and we don't really know who we're going to be. And so we don't always get a great fit necessarily. So like some of the research that I thought was, you know, really telling was like a researcher who studied specialization timing in different countries in higher ed systems and found that the kids who had to specialize earlier, pick like a narrow focus, did jump out to an income lead when they got out into the work world because they had more specific skills. But those who specialized later would maximize their what's called match quality, the degree of fit between their abilities, their interests, and the work they do, which is really important for performance and motivation. And they would have a faster growth rate when they got out of college. So they would catch after a couple years the earlier specializers, and the earlier specializers would start quitting in much higher numbers. So essentially, the later specializers were winning the trade-off because they had a little more time for experimentation, and so they could get better match quality and have faster growth rates. The thing is, there's no reason, you know, all the evidence suggests that continues throughout your life. You can keep updating your match quality and getting better and better and better to keep your growth rates higher.
Now, that's tough for a kid and a parent. It seems like a lot of the incentives keep going more toward the vocational training. What career are you going to have with that post-high school or maybe even high school education? If the generalized way is maybe better, how do we change those incentives?
Yeah, it's really difficult. And again, when I think about this and when I started thinking about these issues was when I was the science writer at Sports Illustrated. So I started thinking about it in sports. And when I was living, up until recently, I lived in Brooklyn, and there was a U6 travel soccer team that met across the street from me. And that's not because anybody thinks five-year-olds can't find good enough competition in a city of 9 million people. You know, it's because there's adult financial incentives, and these are customers, and there's all these other forces that are doing it. And that's sort of the same thing we have, you know, in a lot of other areas. And I think we really, one of the themes of Range is that the things that you can do to cause the most rapid, immediate improvements in performance often systematically undermine long-term development. And economic research shows that a lot of the benefit of higher education is not learning stuff. It's actually the ability to have this sampling period and learn about yourself. And so I think we should build more of that into the things we do. And there's nothing wrong with vocational training, but it should just be another thing that you're getting to try. In fact, maybe we should even have opportunities for more diverse vocational training, like what the Army has done that when they were having these incredible retention problems with really talented officers, they tried to throw money at them, and that was a waste of $500 million. The ones who were going to stay anyway took it, and the ones who were going to leave left. But they've had more success with what they call talent-based branching, where they get these high-potential officers, and instead of saying, this is your career track, go up or out, they pair them with a coach, and they say, here's a bunch of career tracks, sample one at a time, reflect on how this fit your interests and abilities with your coach, and then try another one and keep zigzagging so we maximize your match quality. And they've had really good retention success with that. So I have some hope that if the Army, as hierarchical as it is, can incorporate some of these principles, that maybe other institutions can as well.
We're talking to David Epstein about his new book. It's called Range: Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. And David, you say you got some pushback from some people who would say, yeah, maybe that works in some things, but in this particular kid's sport, for example, well, you really do have to specialize. All bets are off there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That was primarily from the soccer world. So I was getting these – when I first started writing about it, I was getting these, you know, international emails that were saying, maybe you're stupid American sports, but, you know, not soccer. So fortunately, that was around 2014 after I wrote a first book. And right on cue, after Germany won the World Cup, a German study came out that had tracked the development of the players that went on to win the World Cup and found the exact same thing. They had – most of their play early on was unstructured. They dabbled in other sports. Didn't matter if it was formal or not. And they kept doing that. Not until they were 22 did they start doing more of the so-called deliberate practice, the technical practice, than people who were in the amateur leagues. And after that, the German researchers did a study where they actually matched kids at certain ages for ability, as they were assessed by coaches, tracked them for several years, and saw who improved more by the next benchmark. And it was those who had done more other sports improved by the next benchmark.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sam is with us in Madison. Sam, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Sam?
So I'm kind of one of the specialists currently. I started in arboriculture. I've been a tree climber since I was 19. And that's definitely one of those things where specializing and being so career-driven has completely eaten my work-life balance. And now I'm 7 years later, I'm looking for a career change and switching into a different trade and looking for something that I can spread my interest more generally and have time for hobbies and kind of not even just career focused, but be more of a generalist in what I do with my time off of work.
Sam, thanks a lot for the call. So 19 isn't super early to get into the tree business, David, but what do you think of what you're hearing from Sam there? He went whole hog into the trees and now he's looking for a way out maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was really interesting and thoughtful, first of all. And again, when we need specialists, we need both. But I think that's not uncommon, where maybe he'll become more of a generalist because now he'll be switching careers, right? And if you do multiple things. But again, he's talking about 19, right? You're at the very beginning of the fastest time decade of your personality change in your entire life. So it's not really surprising that some of your priorities change later. And I don't think he should worry about it too much, because eventually he'll find a way. Like, I was living in a tent in the Arctic when I decided to get into writing, right? And it turned out that my very ordinary science skills became extraordinary when I got to Sports Illustrated. So you can use those old skills to do what's called skill stacking, you know, where you may not be the best at every single thing, but if you stack enough different types of skills, you have this unique experience. And that sort of shows up in, like, Nobel laureate scientists are far more likely in studies of their lives to have outside hobbies, like, you know, art or writing, music, whatever. And they seem sort of disconnected, but in many cases they sort of end up interacting with some of their other interests. So one of the psychologists who studied scientific creativity called it their network of enterprise, where they had these other things that people saw as distractions, but it actually informed their work anyway, even though I think they were just doing it for joy. So from the standpoint of how we know personality changes, Sam's story doesn't surprise me at all. And I hope that as he moves on to whatever he moves on to, he'll recognize that he can take some of the skills he's learned and transfer them, even if that's hard to see for now.
Thanks, Sam, for that call. Good luck as you move on to a new career. We're talking to David Epstein, author of the new book, Range: Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. Back to your calls now. Brianna is with us in Grafton. Brianna, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Brianna?
I am kind of a generalist. I have experience in a lot of areas, and I would like to know the best way to approach putting that on a resume for an employer, because I see a lot of employers kind of go, every time they see all the different certifications, etc., that I have.
Interesting. So how can we sell ourselves and the benefits of our generalized experience, David?
And that's exactly one of the big problems. And that's one of the issues that convinced me to do this book, because I was talking about some of this research to people who got scholarships from the Pat Tillman Foundation for military veterans to aid career changes. And they were getting a lot of that because they were all switching careers. So they were getting this, the resume doesn't fit quite perfectly. And I think that's a real problem because, and I think like maybe LinkedIn has accelerated that because you can look through so many kind of square pegs for the square hole of a job that you maybe narrow your search, even though LinkedIn's own research on 500,000 members shows that the best predictor of who's going to become an executive is the number of different job functions across an industry that someone has worked. And yet, I still think we're kind of resistant to that idea. So I think what we have to do, and what I've sort of tried to help some of those, those veterans do, is try to build a narrative out of that resume, where you have a little more narrative and a little less of the bullet points to show like why something grew out of a certain interest, and so they feel more connected, right? So again, like I was in grad school for geology, but I've learned how to draw these connections for my story that makes it seem sort of like a holistic growth path, even if sometimes I had no idea what I was doing prospectively. And so I wish we didn't face this kind of resistance. But it is there. And so I think the challenge is to try to, instead of try to form the resume and you're talking so that you show this sort of consistent growth, even if it's not as linear as other people they look at.
Brianna, good luck. Thanks for calling. We'll go now to Eric with us in Endeavor. Eric, hi.
Hello. You know, I felt marginalized my whole life, and especially by my parents, because I never stuck to one thing and I did a bunch of different trades. And I'm 48 years old now, and I'm very in demand as a utility person. I can do a lot of things, and I have no problem finding good pay and work at this point. And
fantastic. Thank you for sharing that, Eric. Yeah, I was always a fan of utility infielders in my baseball-loving days, David, and it sounds like Eric is that in the trade world.
Well, and I think one of the things there is when you're diversified, like you're diversified in anything you do, like you're diversified in your investment portfolio, you become less fragile to changes that come with the market. So it may take you some time. You may have to invest in those skills and diversifying your skills. But, the work world changes pretty fast, and I'm not sure you really want to hinge on just one skill. In some cases, you can. And I talk about that in the book, these so-called kind learning environments where specialists really thrive. But that's sort of a minority of the world. And I think when you have this diverse skill set, you're a lot less fragile in the career sense to changes.
Thanks a lot for that call. David, what is your message for people in the work world looking to hire maybe some of the callers we've had to maybe change that mindset?
Oh yeah, and I'm just going to pass on the advice that I quote in Range from Abby Griffin, who studies, people who really contribute to their companies over and over and over, and also these serial innovators who make these huge contributions. And basically, her advice to HR people is stop defining your job so narrowly, because you are accidentally screening out your highest potential employees who have these diverse interests, who bring knowledge from other domains that you won't have otherwise, that have contacts in other areas, that have a desire to learn outside of their domain. And so I think we should make our pipelines a little more flexible and look for these diverse experiences, even though they won't always look like the square peg for the square hole. But as Abby Griffin mentions, they are in many cases the highest potential for impact employees, but you're accidentally screening them out if you have too rigid of a template for what you want.
And David, let's wrap up maybe by bringing this home for parents who, with really good intentions, they're worried that maybe I'm failing my kids if I don't get them a head start on this career path, whatever it might be. What would you say to them?
Well, so most of these head start, most of the kinds of programs that try to give kids head starts, whether it's sports or in school, they tend toward the things that cause the fastest improvement right in front of your face. And that's what they do, is they teach so-called closed skills. That's basically knowledge of procedures. And it turns out that whether it's a kid learning math or an athlete, the way to make the best 10-year-old is not the same as the way to make the best 20-year-old. And in many cases, and this was one of the deeply counterintuitive themes for me, in many cases, the things that cause the most rapid short-term improvement systematically undermine your long-term development. So I think the approach to take is not worry about a tiger or Mozart. And by the way, they were not father created. Their fathers first reacted to their displays of prowess and interest. So as Tiger said, his father never asked him to play golf. So you don't have to worry about missing those. And instead, take that talent-based branching approach like the Army, where you facilitate a lot of opportunities. And your job as the coach is to then help the kid reflect on those opportunities so they get the maximum amount of learning about themselves and the world from each of those opportunities.
It's a good place to leave it, David. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was David Epstein, science writer. He joined us to talk about his new book called Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. If you have a story along these lines as a parent, as a kid or former kid yourself, or maybe something from your working life or educational life, love to hear from you. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. School mascots have made headlines in recent years with concerns ranging from appropriateness to racism to cultural appropriation. Our next guest says that some schools in Wisconsin and beyond have another mascot that should get a second look, the Crusader. In an opinion piece, she writes that Crusader mascots represent Christian domination over those who aren't Christian and are a throwback to a time of brutality, genocide, and violence. Karen Park is an associate professor of theology and religious studies at St. Norbert College in De Pere. She wrote the opinion piece in Sojourners magazine titled Confronting Christian Antisemitism, One Mascot at a Time. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, this is a personal issue for you because this is your alma mater in high school, their mascot.
Yes, it is. I graduated from Catholic Memorial High School back in 1987.
Why did you decide to give Crusader as a mascot a second closer look?
Well, so I teach Christian history at St. Norbert College, and this fall I was teaching my Christian traditions class, and we read a lot of primary source material. We read a document from the First Crusade, so from the early 11th century, called The Slaughter of the Rhineland Jews in my class. And the very next day was the massacre at the synagogue, Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And so the next week when we got back to class, you know, the students were really trying to process what this meant, that, you know, it was that this brutality and you know, against Jews was part of their history that they were learning, and then here it was playing out in real time. And so I was thinking about it. And we put together a couple weeks later, we put together a panel at St. Norbert with other professors in history, Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant, and we had sort of a discussion about ongoing issues of anti-Semitism in the church. And at that time, I used an example, just to sort of bring up questions, and said, you know, my alma mater here in Wisconsin is the Crusaders. You know, what does it mean to have a mascot, the Crusaders, today? And that's sort of where it began.
What kind of things did you and the other people on your panel, maybe your students, talk about when you talked about Crusaders as a mascot, given that background?
Well, it wasn't the Crusaders as mascot wasn't really the focus of that panel, although we did talk a little bit about it being something that most people hadn't thought about. Some students had even gone to that high school as well and hadn't really thought about what the history of that term was, what it meant, and what it might mean today. And so that they were mostly just interested in exploring that and thinking through it.
What does it mean to you to have Crusader as a mascot for your high school, but also for others around? I know there are at least one or two more in Wisconsin and others at colleges and high schools around the country.
Right. So I wrote to the high school after the first synagogue shooting this year, and I asked to be removed from the mailing list because I don't want to be a Crusader. I think that the Crusader, it's not a neutral term. It's a term from a time of profound religious violence and intolerance. The First Crusade was launched to eliminate Muslims from Jerusalem. The Pope at that time called them alien to God. You know, so it's not a neutral term. I don't think we get to decide what it means. It has a historical context attached to it. And so so I wrote and said, you know, please take me off your mailing lists until such time as Catholic Memorial has a different mascot. And, you know, because I don't want to be a Crusader.
And I understand that some schools around the country, at the college level anyway, have moved intentionally away from the Crusader mascot, actually changed their team name.
Yes, that's right. A number of them have. I'm not aware of all of them, But I know Wheaton College, which is an evangelical Christian school, had the Crusader in Illinois, had the Crusader mascot until the year 2000, and then changed it back then to, I think, the Thunder. Holy Cross College, which is in Massachusetts, had 2 years of questioning and discussion about the mascot. And then for now, they've decided to retain it, but they are continuing to talk it over, as I understand it. And I know that some student organizations, including the newspaper, have independently decided to eliminate Crusader from their title because of its medieval history of intolerance and, frankly, genocide.
Talking to Karen Park, Associate Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at St. Norbert College in De Pere. She wrote an opinion piece in Sojourners Magazine about the Crusader mascot. Some schools, including her high school alma mater, use that. She's looking for a change. Do you see this as part of a broader conversation about teaching about how we talk about churches, religions, and how they relate to each other?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we need to talk about it, right? And that's what I'm hoping will happen. I hope that this conversation can begin. I think that to say, as I said earlier, just to say, well, we think it is a positive thing, and so we get to decide that, Catholic Memorial High School, for example, it's not enough. We need to take seriously, for example, what it might mean to be a Muslim or Jewish student, either at a high school with a Crusaders mascot or even facing one on the football field or on the tennis court. When your opponent is a Crusader named after a person of the past whose goal was to eliminate you from the face of the earth, that means something. We should talk about that. And I think Christian schools have an obligation to do that. And there's precedent, right? Of course, Marquette decided to get rid of their Warriors mascot, 25 years ago, because it took a leadership stance on that, because it was offensive to Native Americans. And Marquette has survived and thrived after making that decision. So I think that that's what I'm looking for.
I've seen some defenses of the idea of sticking with Crusader along the lines of schools will go to Spartans, for example, or Trojans as an example of a group that fought for what they believed in. They're not necessarily adapting all the connotations of it, the negatives that might have gone along with it. So can we separate out the bad baggage from maybe a positive message, as they say?
I would say that the Crusader is different. A Spartan is a fighter. We can have emblems that connote strength and valiant, even warfare, although I would argue that there are probably better models for sportsmanship than warfare. But the Crusades were different. This was an organized and sanctified violence. It was linking violence to God's will. And so I think that that's where the Crusader mascot is different from other mascots that also involve, perhaps warfare, because this warfare during the time of the Crusades was explicitly linked to God's will. And so that's where I think we have a case to say that, no, the Crusader is different.
And unlike Spartans, I think in some cases around the world of mass shootings where people are motivated by a right-wing ideology, they point toward Crusaders in some cases as an example. Is that part of the conversation you want to see out there?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And so if we look at, unfortunately, this year, and that's also what prompted me to write the article. I'm teaching this history during a year marked by extraordinary religious violence on the part of largely white self-identified Christian males to the religious other, namely Muslims and Jews, that took place this year. And I'm referring to the Tree of Life massacre in October, of course, the mosque shooting in New Zealand in March, and then another synagogue shooting here in San Diego in April. And in all cases, those shooters used language against Jews, against Muslims, and were inspired by sometimes language about Christian warfare. I know that the shooter in New Zealand expressed admiration for another white supremacist shooter in Norway and referred to him as Knight Breivik. And so it's explicitly calling on Crusader, sort of imagery and myth and language to sanctify religious violence against Muslims and Jews. And so, I absolutely do not believe that Catholic Memorial is an anti-Semitic or Islamophobic school. I had a good experience there, But I think that the mascot is something that is now being held onto during a time of increasing religious violence against Muslims and Jews in this country. And that is, you know, what we're seeing.
We'll leave it there for now. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Karen Park is an associate professor of theology and religious studies at St. Norbert College in De Pere. She joined us to talk about her opinion piece, Confronting Christian Antisemitism, One Mascot at a Time. We did reach out to Catholic Memorial High School in Waukesha, requesting either an interview with the school's president or a statement. The president was not available, and they declined to offer a statement at this time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. After increasing calls to break up some of technology's biggest companies, the federal government may now be making moves in that direction. Yesterday, the House Judiciary Committee said it will conduct a bipartisan investigation into whether there's enough competition for big technology companies. In addition, the Justice Department is reportedly considering its own investigation of Google. Apple, Google, Facebook, and Amazon have all come under scrutiny in recent years for dominating several markets, including social networking, e-commerce, and mobile apps. Matt Mitten is a law professor at Marquette University. His areas of specialty include antitrust law. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, this Congressional Judiciary Committee, they don't, in their press release, mention any companies by name. They say, quoting, a small number of dominant, unregulated platforms. But that sounds a lot like Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple, right?
I would certainly think so.
So when we take antitrust law, the concept of antitrust, and look at these technology companies, is there a case to be made that they have too much monopoly power?
Well, there's nothing wrong with having monopoly power. The question is, how did you get it and what are you doing to maintain it? So antitrust law at bottom is designed to ensure that consumers get the benefit of free and open market competition. And there's nothing wrong with a company becoming very large. I mean, they may come up with an innovative idea, and, you know, with technology, there's certain, you know, externalities. You know, the more users you get on a platform or things, it, you know, makes it work better, it's more valuable. So there's nothing wrong with that. The question is, are you doing things to stifle competitive opportunities by other companies? That's the real issue for purposes of antitrust law.
What do you see when you look at these big companies? Do you see them taking actions that stifle the potential for competition to rise up against them?
Well, we have seen it. If we go back and, you know, kind of the first ones with technology was, you know, the government broke up the Bell companies. And now they're kind of combining back together. Then we saw with Microsoft, you know, they had dominance, you know, huge share of the market for computer software operating system. What are they doing to, you know, perhaps prevent makers of peripheral devices and other applications, things like that, from, you know, entering the market? And we're seeing kind of the same thing here. Concerns with Facebook, they acquired some companies. All of these companies gather a lot of information, so they know who the competitors are, who are the rising companies, and they've got a lot of money. So if they start buying them, that eliminates competition, or if they're doing other things to prevent others from potentially competing with them. That's why Congress and the Department of Justice Antitrust Division and the FTC is expressing some concerns.
If Congress or one of those federal regulatory agencies decides, yeah, Company X is a problem, what are the range of remedies from nothing to break up the company?
Well, let's start with either the Federal Trade Commission or the Antitrust Division. They have essentially concurrent jurisdiction to enforce the federal antitrust laws. And the one here that comes into play is Section 2, which prohibits monopolization and attempts to monopolize. And again, it doesn't prohibit monopolies. It's just, what are you doing to acquire and maintain your monopoly? They, you know, it would likely be a civil action rather than a criminal prosecution. It's rare that courts will grant structural relief. Typically, what they will do is they will issue an order requiring the offending company to stop the anti-competitive practices. And so that's what's likely to occur there. Congress can hold hearings, hold some you know, CEOs' feet to the fire, ask them some really hard questions. But really, unless they want to modify the federal antitrust laws, which is, you know, always a possibility, I think they're just more likely to, you know, exert public pressure. But to actually, you know, result in changed business practices, the FTC and the antitrust division can do that through the judicial system.
100 years ago or so, it seems like we saw a lot more antitrust action. Is there something about technology companies that make them a different animal when it comes to monopolization and antitrust?
Yeah, I think so, because it's kind of, you know, you get on the same network. There's economies of scale. And, you know, the way these things work, it tends toward there being a winner in each of these different segments or just a couple companies. And that's where Section 2 comes into play, is that, you know, once a company has it, you know, roughly a 50% or more market share, that's when concerns for purposes of Section 2 come into play. There's much more scrutiny as to, okay, it's okay if you're, you know, offering products or services that customers want, you're winning the competitive struggle. But Section 2 is designed to maintain a level playing field, and companies with certain size can't be doing things that are considered predatory or exclusionary of their competitors.
You mentioned Microsoft earlier, and they were investigated, and they did, if I understand things correctly, have to change some of their practices. What kind of remedies did we see there coming out of their alleged anti-competitive behavior?
Well, I think it was largely they were prohibiting, you know, exclusive dealing contracts where Microsoft was entering into companies saying, hey, if you want to do business with us, you can't do business with our competitors, or certain integrated technology that really wasn't necessary to provide a better functioning computer. It was just simply designed to keep others out of the market. So, you know, it would be a case by case, you know, analysis of a specific business practice. And the question is basically, is this fair competition on the merits, or which is legal, or unfair, exclusionary, or predatory practices that, you know, drive out one's competitors, and that would be illegal.
Talking to Matt Mitten, law professor at Marquette University, about some congressional hearings that are likely on the way and possible action from the executive branch as well on monopolies, antitrust action potentially against technology companies like Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple. Matt, is there evidence out there now that suggests that that the feds would take action against these companies, or is this the kind of thing that, okay, they'd investigate, and if they can find a pattern, maybe in emails or company documents, things like that, a pattern where a company intentionally did anti-competitive actions, is that the kind of level it would take to actually have some action happen?
Well, you know, intent, you know, is something that can be, you know, that's hard to say how that, what they'd be focusing on is what is the marketplace effect of particular business practices. And in cases where it's a little bit uncertain, that's where you would rely on, you know, internal documents of the company to kind of see, well, what was their objective in instituting a particular practice or stopping, you know, or acquiring a particular company or not doing business with someone else. They would try to piece all that together, but the focus is really more on the particular business practice and what is its anti-competitive effects.
Let's take a look at Amazon in particular, because they aren't just what we buy stuff from. They also provide a lot of the behind-the-scenes things for a lot of websites, and they're coming into competition with a lot of brick-and-mortar retailers as well. Is there going to be a lot of investigation of the different ways that Amazon's infrastructure could give them an advantage over competitors in a number of different fields of the economy?
Yeah, that's why it would be, you know, we're starting to see the FTC, and or at least it's reported, the FTC and Department of Justice are kind of going to split this up rather than one agency investigating all of them, because it's going to take a lot of resources to take a, you know, to look at it. And if we use Amazon as an example, you'd have to focus on, okay, you know, clearly they compete with, you know, brick and mortar retailers for sales, but they operate as a platform in a lot of different areas. So each of those will be examined very carefully, and it might well be a situation where the conclusion is that, okay, here, although we're concerned about it, at this point, you know, probably not enough to make out an antitrust violation. But on a couple other areas, and I suspect that both the antitrust division and the Federal Trade Commission, they'll pick their spots pretty carefully, unless they decide to say, hey, we've got to break up one or more of these companies to result in a competitive market. Although, again, that's going to be a much more significant antitrust case that is going to require a lot more proof, take a lot longer.
In our last minute and a half or so, I asked earlier if these technology companies were a different animal than antitrust actions dealt with in the past. Are our laws on monopolies and antitrust keeping up with the times to deal with a company like Facebook or Amazon?
Well, you know, that's the $64,000 question. The antitrust laws were enacted, the Sherman Act, back in 1890, when we had essentially a rural agrarian economy, and now we've got a global high-tech economy, and they're intentionally written pretty broad. They prohibit agreements that unreasonably restrain trade. That's Section 1 in a nutshell. Section 2 prohibits monopolization or attempted monopolization of any segment of commerce or trade. So I think they're broad enough to cover this sort of thing. What's difficult is how do we apply that language specifically today? And whether or not, I think it would require a modification of the antitrust law just to prohibit companies from getting to a certain size and having market power, particularly in technology. But that would be a pretty significant change. Because again, traditionally, there's been nothing wrong with winning the competitive struggle and just becoming big. It's just what you do with it. So we could have that situation here where there's some collateral effects that aren't really anti-competitive, but nevertheless, there's economic and political effects that Congress might be concerned with. Perhaps
Matt,
we move to a regulatory environment.
We'll leave it there, Matt. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Bye.
That's now. Matt Mitten, law professor at Marquette University. We talked with him about the House Judiciary Committee's antitrust investigation coming up into the big technology companies, also possible action from the Department of Justice. Today is National Cheese Day. That's got a lot of people excited here in Wisconsin. But I read into some interesting cheese news all the way from Switzerland. In honor of the Cheese Day, NPR linked a story that they ran a few months back. I missed it at the time, though. Cheese researchers in Switzerland tried this experiment to see if playing music for cheese might change the flavor, because maybe the microorganisms that make the cheese would respond to the sounds and vibrations. For 6 months, wheels of Emmental cheese, it's a kind of cheese, were exposed to a different style of music. One wheel got some Mozart, one got Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven, and so on. There's also a control cheese that didn't get any music. Otherwise, the cheeses were the same. They were made from the same batch of milk and so on. They made them as similarly as they could otherwise. Then after 6 months, the wheels of Emmental cheese were carted out and served to a panel of experts and to a panel of Swiss chefs, artists, and politicians. And there was a clear winner. The richest, fruitiest flavor came from the cheese that listened for 6 months to hip-hop music. So if you have some cheese handy, hold it up to your speakers for one of the songs they used in that experiment from A Tribe Called Quest. This is Central Time. Don't deserve the gall, don't deserve the praise. The tranquility will make you unball your fist. For we put hip hop on a brand new twist. A brand new twist with a whole heap of mystic. So low key that you probably missed it. But yet it's so loud that it stands in the crowd. When the guy takes the beat, they bowed. So raise up, squire, adjust your attire. We have no time to wallow in the mire.